Hey, everybody, it's Farron Cousins, and usually this is the part where I would welcome you to the show and let you know who was on the show, but you know what? Today, I'm going to let our very special guest welcome you to the show, so here you go.
Welcome to Ring of Fire. I am your guest, Sam Cedar.
Sam Cedar, ladies and gentlemen, he is back with us on Ring of Fire. Sam, listen, a lot has happened. You've handed the show over to me about a year ago. I'd like to think I've done a pretty good job of keeping it going here. But you know what? A lot has happened in that year. We have had January 6th committee. We have had about 8,000 investigations into Donald Trump. We've got the midterms that at once looked like a red wave. Then the Democrats might come back, and now polls are shifting the other way. So look, we're going to talk about pretty much everything we can today. But let's start, obviously, midterms. We got, you know, a week or two away at this point. So, again, 6 months ago, you had Republicans, McConnell, everybody out there predicting 60 to 70 seats. That was their projection at the time. Then Mitch McConnell came out over the summer and said, guys, we're going to have to temper our expectations a bit. I don't think we're going to do so well. And now polls evening out in races that once were just absolute, you know, like Fetterman, as I think is a great example. 14 points ahead a couple weeks ago. That's dropped back down to single digits. So without, you know, getting into each race in particular just yet, what's your overall feeling as we head into this, you know, voting season?
Well, two of the big things that you missed over the past year was the Dobbs ruling. That's what basically changed the calculus, I think, for the midterm elections. And I think to some extent, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which is not really an Inflation Reduction Act, I think passing that is not going to have the impact. I don't think anything is going to have the impact, at least in terms of like Democratic turnout, that the overturning of Roe v. Wade did. But the Inflation Reduction Act keeps the narrative from being the Democrats don't do anything. And certainly people can, you know, I think they're, it's perfectly reasonable to have a tremendous amount of frustration about the limitations on the Inflation Reduction Act, but in some things it's very, very, it's very strong. It's just not as much as, you know, is needed in this moment. And then the reduction, you know, Biden's reduction in student debt, assuming the Republicans don't prevail in court in reversing that, I think that's a big deal. I think the recent cannabis reform is a big deal. I mean, because I really do think that he is on the track to, at the very least, decriminalize on a federal level. And, you know, I'm sure, like, the implications of that are huge because it means that on states that have legalized pot, you can start the dispensaries can start involving themselves in like banking in issues like this, and it could theoretically allow for cross state sales, and it's just moving the ball forward. Again, Joe Biden's never going to do as much as I want him to do, but you know, and I don't think that he's necessarily exceeded my expectations, but I mean, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
And so, overall, I think, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, like it's literally like the seesaw teetering right on the fulcrum, right? But the bottom line is, like, you can have those soft landings on the seesaw, but I think it's going to fall on one side. So you mentioned the race tightening with Oz and Fetterman. Now, you know, a new poll just came out, I think, Thursday of, you know, like I say, we're a couple of weeks out, where Tim Ryan and J.D. Vance are tied. And that's sort of shocking. Ohio is, you know, do I think that Tim Ryan's going to win that race? Probably not, but it's super close. Wisconsin's like getting a little bit too much separation between Johnson and Mandela Barnes at this moment, but and we've got, you know, New Hampshire and Nevada, Amasto Cortez's opponent's family, like 14 members of this guy's family just came out and endorsed his opponent. So, you know, we don't know how that's going to work there. And then, you know, I don't think Val Demings is going to pull out in Florida, but it's possible. In North Carolina, Beasley is basically tied right now. You know, it's really tough to say. If I had to bet right now, I'd say Democrats are going to hold the Senate. You know, and that the Democrats will lose the House by how much? I don't know. 10, 15 seats, 5 seats. I don't know. It's conceivable the Democrats pick up 2 seats in the Senate. It's so tight. It's so difficult to get a sense. But I will say this. The problem that Democrats have on midterm elections, off-year elections, has historically been 3/4 of Republicans come out to vote. 2/3 of Democrats come out to vote. That's the dilemma. But with the Dobbs ruling, the question's going to be, are we going to see what we saw in 2018, which is record-breaking Republican turnout, but even more record-breaking Democratic turnout? I don't know that we're going to break those records, but the Democrats were coming out in 2018 to vote against Trump. And Trump wasn't on the ballot, so they voted against anybody who was associated with Trump. This time, I think the Democrats, you know, the extra push for them coming out is Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
And in both those instances, you know, it's women who are coming out to vote. And so, you know, I'm encouraged. But really, like, for me, I would like to see a 52-seat Senate. But the value of that is only really, at the end of the day, is if the Democrats get the House.
Yeah.
Right? Because you want them to pass legislation on voting rights. You want them to pass legislation on a woman's ability to choose an abortion. You have to basically make carve-outs for those in the filibuster. If we get 52 votes in the Senate that are Democratic, they will carve out the filibuster for those two bills, I believe.
Yeah.
But if you don't have the House, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But what does matter is, as of the 2022 midterms, Joe Biden will be on pace to match Trump's lifetime appointments to the judiciary. Year to date, almost, you know, term to date, if you will, almost identical, which is astonishing because there were a lot more openings for Trump than there were for Biden, because Obama, frankly, the Obama administration did not take it seriously enough. And the Biden administration seems to have learned that. So the real question is going to be, are we going to get, at the end of 4 years of Joe Biden, as many appointments to the federal bench, lifetime appointments, that Donald Trump did? Probably not as many Supreme Court choices, but this is huge. This is a huge deal. I mean, you know this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but broadly speaking, I'm not sure that this is the first time in my lifetime where there is a real sense that the administration gets it. And the Senate has been just plowing through it. It will come to a screeching halt if Mitch McConnell gets the gavel. Period. End of story. And here's the frustrating part. That dynamic, I think, is one of the least pointed to ones as to why Donald Trump won. That empty seat on the Supreme Court is what motivated a huge portion of the evangelical vote in the Republican Party, which is enormous, to vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, lower court judges aren't as sexy. We don't know the names of them. Right. We, you know, but it is my greatest lamentation that Democratic voters, leftists, whomever, do not appreciate the importance of the judiciary, because, you know, you can see, like, the idea that it's the single most important thing that the Senate can do with 50 votes. Well, I mean, pretty close. I mean, we've seen some pretty good legislation pass. But nobody's ever going to mention it in the campaign because it just doesn't resonate with people.
Well, and you actually sound exactly like Pap saying that, because that's something he and I have talked about, obviously, for years. And it's worth noting for everybody, Sam and I are actually at a legal conference while we're sitting here talking to each other. So that's definitely something that's on our mind. And I will point this out, too, about Biden's judicial picks is, unlike Obama, who picked a lot of corporate lawyers, unfortunately, we have seen a lot of Biden's appointments that were former plaintiff's lawyers, the people that took on big corporations. We have seen public defenders, which is huge.
More public defenders than have ever been appointed by a president, as far as I can tell.
And folks have to understand just how important that is, because the background matters. Who you have represented matters. That does influence your judicial philosophy.
Without a doubt.
So those have been great picks, and that is definitely something I
There's been some ones that are not so great.
Well,
but,
right.
But in terms of like a as a pool of these, the most diverse, both like ethnically, racially, in terms of gender, which, you know, I am excited about, but I'm even more excited about the diversity of legal disciplines that they're coming from, because and you know this as well as anybody, and Pap does too, like, you know, they're making decisions on these circuit courts that are that implicate people's everyday lives, and nobody knows about it.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, I should say, is that you tell me the decision that comes down now, and I will tell you who appointed that. I will tell you who appointed that judge. That's just the way it is. There is, you know, there are occasions where Republican-appointed judges, George W. Bush or George Herbert Walker Bush, will rule in favor of – will rule in a way that I think the outcome should be. But if there's some bat crap crazy decision, bet your kids 529, bet your, you know, life insurance policy – your pension, whatever it is, that it's Trump-appointed judge.
You know, another thing I have to point out here, because when we're talking about turnout, obviously, for the midterms as well, there's an X factor. And this is something that is unfortunately not reflected in the polls, because most pollsters, based on polling data, they're pulling numbers based on the 2020 census. A lot has changed in America since the 2020 census was conducted, especially more than a million people dying of COVID. Studies have come out and they have shown us, obviously, more Republicans have died than Democrats. And I know it's morbid to think about that. However, when you're using the 2020 census as your polling base, which is what the pollsters do, they go on the most recent census. That's how they break it down, right? If we got an area that was 60-40 Republican-Democrat, for every 60 Republicans, we talk to 40 Democrats. Those numbers could be slightly different. It could be a 58-42, and I know that doesn't change an election, but I do think overall you've got some closer districts out there, so we could end up seeing maybe a handful of races that completely defy the polling. And I don't even think it could necessarily swing the election, but we're going to see polls that have been way off, a lot of it again because of COVID deaths. And that actually concerns me to a degree, because then you're going to end up with Republicans looking at this saying, oh, well, no, we were supposed to win by 10 points. We won by 5.
Oh, yeah.
Clearly,
that's gonna
it's the fraud.
That's going to happen. It would happen regardless of what the polls were. I mean, I'm a little skeptical about that because I suspect that if you look at the data, the Republicans who you are in, probably you are more likely to be in a heavily red district if you were that attuned to, you know, Sean Hannity saying it was a hoax for X amount of time and, you know, wearing a mask is child abuse and stuff like that. You're probably in a redder district. So maybe the polling differences is not going to change the outcome of that particular election. I mean, yeah, listen, the polls could say Democrats are going to win by 25% and the Republicans are going to come out the day after going like, we were robbed. Like, they started with the fake polling and then they did the fake election. I mean, that's, yeah, it's happening either way. Right? I mean,
well, we've already seen them claim it in their own primaries against other Republicans.
I mean,
this Republican rigged it against me.
Of course, of course. I mean, we have a big problem in this country with sort of a fascistic authoritarian rise, and it is so hard, I think, for most people to sort of decipher because both sides are using that language now. The fact that both sides are using that language, in other words, that the right is lobbing those same accusations back at Democrats and the left, that it effectively makes it harder to assess. But we've got a real problem, and I think there's only so much. I mean, I think the Democrats are handling it fairly well, but I definitely think that one of the ways that you stave off authoritarians and fascist movements like this is by having your government function well. And by government, I also mean like the legislative body. My biggest concern is if you get gridlock for a couple of years, that's all it's going to take for people just to be sort of like disaffected. And I'm not going to deal with it. I mean, you know, look, I think it's a little bit overstated with Trump. 95% of the people who voted for Donald Trump voted for Mitt Romney, right? But I do think that there is a certain sort of like frustration with the political system, and where it convinced people like Donald Trump's going to come in and he's going to break stuff. And, you know, maybe that's good. I mean, you know, I think some people had that attitude. Some people still have that attitude. Yeah. And the way you defeat that is by not having gridlock. The way you don't have gridlock is you get 52 votes in the Senate and you retain the House. But if that doesn't happen, I worry. I worry more about that than the screams that they stole the election. It doesn't matter. And you know, and I will say, like, there needs to be material benefits that's delivered by government. But I also think that, like, they need to do stuff. They need to be able to successfully do stuff. Part of it is, you know, the press isn't very good about, like, reporting the actual narrative, and they create a different one. But I think that's really, really important. Like, I think the value of what Joe Biden is doing in terms of, like, student debt, cannabis reform, the IRA, the, you know, Inflation Reduction Act, those steps are not as sufficient as I think they should be, but one of the values on top of all the merits involved in them is that it's showing there's some response. The government is being responsive. May not be, you know, maybe giving you half half the sandwich instead of the whole sandwich, maybe a quarter of the sandwich and the whole sandwich. But the message is that, like, you know, I hear you. You want a sandwich. This is all I'm giving you. But it's in terms of maintaining people's faith in a democratic, small d, governance, I think that's really, really important and really undersold. And so I worry about the implications of 2 years of gridlock.
Which is exactly what Republicans have already promised. They've said, look,
without a doubt,
we're turning every committee into an investigatory committee.
Every committee into an investigative committee. They're already planning on, like, trying to attack Social Security and Medicare via the debt ceiling. I mean, God, Democrats should just have, like, vote to get rid of the debt ceiling. It's stupid. It's a stupid, arcane process. You've already spent the money. You've already spent the money. It's like literally like you're okay using the credit card, but we got to have a talk when it comes time to whether we're going to pay for it. Like, wait, what? Wait, why are you letting them use a credit card then? Like, I mean, it's ridiculous.
So I also want to ask, you know, when we're talking about House and Senate races, obviously the one I think most of the nation right now is looking at is Georgia. Herschel Walker is...
Georgia.
Walker's quite the guy. But listen, here's what gets me, and I want to get your opinion on this. You have other Republicans running tight elections where they could either flip seats or they're in danger of losing a Republican-controlled seat. Dr. Oz, Blake Masters could flip it. Oz could retain it. You know, J.D. Vance, like you mentioned in Ohio, close race. Yeah. But Republicans, Fox News, they're all rushing. We just had Rick Scott, Tom Cotton go down to Georgia, campaign for Herschel Walker. Fox News is having him on three times a day. They are hyper-focused on making sure Herschel Walker wins as opposed to some of these other guys. So why Walker? What's his value?
Okay.
I have a theory, but I want to hear what you have to say.
And let me just add one sort of like one qualification to what you said. Like, I think the data shows that they've mentioned Fetterman's name more times over the past, like, two or three times around the fact that he has to use closed captioning to understand the questions that are being asked of him. And but why they surround themselves with Walker is everybody knows. It's because they have a problem on race, and having two African American senators who are Republicans, it's a big deal for them. I don't know if that's ever been the case. I don't know if that's ever happened.
I don't think it has.
I mean, probably during Reconstruction, but certainly not in the past, let's say, 120 years. And there's a lot of value to white people to have a black person who is validating. I mean, you saw it with Kanye and his, like,
yep.
You know, they're willing to tolerate the guy's anti-Semitism and, like, clear psychological issues, and they're willing to celebrate him because he wore a White Lives Matter t-shirt.
So a lot of it, you know, and that ties into my theory about it as well, because Walker's the useful idiot. And I mean that in probably every possible sense of that phrase, because one, obviously, with no political experience, the guy has no idea what he would be doing.
Yeah.
So he's easily malleable. They can use him, as you said, to play their race card, like, hey, we need somebody to go and sell this. You're the guy. And he will say whatever they want him to say because he doesn't know any better. I mean, not just politically speaking, but personally, I think we should be looking at CTE issues.
Yeah.
The guy played in the league before you even had a concussion protocol and all of this higher tech equipment. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely a possibility. But they view that seat not only as one that they want back because they believe that's a rightful red seat, but by putting somebody in there that can be the biggest puppet, and you know there will be no pushback. You know, he's not like a Mitt Romney that may occasionally say, well, I can't go with you on this, or a Murkowski. Whatever they want, Walker will do it, and he can be their pitch man whenever they need to trot him out. It's disgusting, especially considering the caliber of candidate here. You know, forget the hypocrisy, just the horrible not knowing how anything on the planet works issue to me.
Yeah, but Tommy Tuberville.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, Ron Johnson. These people are idiots. I mean, Donald Trump. You know,
McConnell got his whole wish list from Trump, too. And I think a lot of people kind of take for granted just how much Mitch McConnell really was manipulating so much behind the scenes. He didn't like the crazy, but he puts up with it because I can get my tax cuts, I can get my judges, I can get all of this horrible right-wing policy.
The number of judges he got through was extraordinary. And he got Trump elected, I think, in part because of keeping that seat open.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, absolutely.
To watch those fights now, too, Trump coming after McConnell, you got Rick Scott, who I think is obviously gunning for McConnell's position as leader. Kicking McConnell out of leadership would be great for America, but that would be the dumbest move I think the Republican Party could make. Because Mitch McConnell's a lot of things. He's an evil genius, but he's a genius, politically speaking.
I agree.
So,
I agree.
You know, they're cutting off their, you know, own head if they want to get rid of him, but that's where they're headed with this.
Yeah, I hope they do it.
It truly would be hilarious. So, all right, a lot of stuff has happened last 2-3 weeks with Donald Trump, including, by the way, folks, the Supreme Court, as I'm sure everybody knows, said we're not gonna look at your documents case here. That's huge. That I didn't expect that at all.
Yeah.
So with that, I mean, obviously, we could sit here and both agree that by the end of the year, Donald Trump's in prison, 100% going to jail, life sentence. No. Is it foolish to even get hopes up?
I don't think he's going to go to jail. I just don't think he is going to. I think it's good that they're, you know, the documents case is just ridiculous. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, he brought it all on himself. Like, they begged him for months. Like, just give us the you know, they're not your documents. Just give them back, and it'll be over. I mean, like, I don't understand why the guy just didn't, like, photocopy the goddamn things. You photocopy them and then give them back. I don't get it. The January 6th stuff, I think, far more important. I do not think it will lead to him being in prison. I think, like, it's important to get on the record, show that there was at least accountability in the sense that, like, people paid attention to it. Like, they didn't just forget about it and ignore it all. You know, the Trump Inc., so, you know, investigation that is happening in New York State, or the Georgia one, those two may present a little more legal jeopardy to him. I'd find it hard to believe he's going to jail. I still have a completely half-baked, borderline, you know, theory that I want to, like, really, really qualify in saying, but I find it astonishing that over the course of Donald Trump's 45 years in real estate business in New York State, that he was never prosecuted for anything. You know, we had the Gambling Commission basically say, like, we're not going to give you a license down in Atlantic City because he was too mobbed up with people. The Justice Department at one point issued a consent decree saying, like, hey, you have to actually rent your apartment. You can't not rent to black people because they're black. But there was never any prosecution of him, and never any indictments. And, you know, it's quite clear he's been lying about, like, the value of his apartments, this one, and, you know, and then lying to shareholders and lying to tax. So lying to somebody, probably both, actually. Probably blew it up way too high for investors, way too low for tax purposes. And God knows what other things he was involved in. And the only other sort of like data point I would add is a guy named Felix Sater, whose name is completely just disappeared, completely disappeared. Wayne Barrett, who was the famous Village Voice reporter, covered Donald Trump more than any other human being in the country. He died the day before Trump won the election. He died of cancer. And I spoke to him quite a bit in 2016 over that summer. And he kept saying, everything is Felix Sater. Felix Sater, Felix Sater, Felix Sater. I don't know if you remember him. He was arrested for trying to stab someone with a champagne flute. And the thing that kept him from being convicted was, in part, an affidavit signed by Loretta Lynch, who was Bill Clinton's former head of, not Bill Clinton, Obama's former head of DOJ. She was also former U.S. attorney in the, I think, the Eastern District of New York. She wrote an affidavit testifying that he was an FBI and CIA informant. In fact, some people think that he's the one who provided the CIA with bin Laden's cell phone number that ultimately led to bin Laden being basically assassinated by the U.S. And he was a money launderer. And he was also providing information to the CIA and the FBI. And he would do one of the big sort of money laundering conduits that people speculated about is like big Russian oligarch money, not just Russian oligarch money. And where would they put this money? Well, he was also had a specific title as special advisor to Donald Trump, had an office in Trump Tower. And I'm convinced that he's facilitating all this money laundering to Donald Trump. And this is a theory that is based upon nothing but what I've said. And, you know, people can think it's, you know, half-baked and half-cocked, and I'm okay with that because on some level that's the way I feel it is too. But it's just stunning to me that Donald Trump was never – there was never a pursuit by an ambitious New York City DA or U.S., you know, I mean, state attorney general or any of these people. And I suspect that knowingly, probably unknowingly, but maybe knowingly, Donald Trump was like an asset for those who were tracking international money laundering. And you know, he was like sort of like the reservoir that Felix Sater was pouring money into. And so, I mean, I think that speaks to why Donald Trump has got such hubris, which you develop, like, look what I've gotten away with. I'm untouchable. And he was.
Yeah.
Maybe he still is. I would just add one other data point. People can go back and I think we'll read the New York Times in October, around the time the Comey letter came out, and before then, there was a massive, like, I think the New York Times said potential mutiny in the New York FBI office, which, of course, worked very closely with Rudy Giuliani when he was U.S. attorney. Rudy Giuliani got rid of the Italian mob in New York, which opened the door for the Russian mob. And I suspect there was a lot of people in the New York FBI office who were on Team Trump. Maybe because they liked the guy, maybe because it was a Whitey Bulger type of situation and they didn't want to, you know, Whitey Bulger from Boston, who was a famous organized crime figure who was actually also a FBI informant. I think it's possible that there were people who were a little bit worried, like, we may have cut some corners at some times, and, like, this is not something that we want to come out. I mean, so I don't know. That's a long way of saying I don't think he's going to jail.
But I do think it's damaged him politically. And I do think that it's, like, important to get this stuff on the record. I think people can miss there's a danger that people can miss the true story, which is, like, Trump was the natural next step for the Republican Party. They didn't take a big jump. They didn't take a big leap. They didn't fall off a cliff. They weren't, you know, he was just the natural progression. You know, that, like, those pictures of evolution where, like, you know, start with an ape and you go like this. That's all he was. He was just the next step in a long trend in this direction.
Right. I mean, you know, God, you could say it started with Nixon. A lot of people say it started with Reagan. But there's obviously been a multi-decades-long trend in the Republican Party to go for the low-hanging fruit type of candidate. You know, George W. Bush, I think, took it definitely to a new low. Then McCain brings us Sarah Palin. Palin opens the door for Michelle Bachmann. We had who was it? Christine, I'm not a witch, O'Donnell.
Right.
And at the time, we're looking at these people like, oh my God, this is not going to get dumber. And now we have Herschel Walker and Dr. Oz. And yeah. 2 years from now, we'll be looking back and saying, well, those guys weren't as bad as whoever, right. You know, whatever circus freak show they've got running exactly. In 2024.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it didn't start with Trump. It sure as hell clearly doesn't end with Trump. On the jail thing, I think you're right. I think Donald Trump is not going to go to jail. Even just they could probably find him guilty of all of this, and it's not going to end up with prison sentences. Having said that, I think a lot of people will go to jail. I think we will definitely see people with the fake elector scheme. Some of them definitely Georgia. Fannie Willis has already said they're now in a period of what she says, basically radio silence.
Dormancy. Yeah. Until the after election. Right.
Yeah. But she has said indictments coming in December. But, you know, we've got the woman on video letting the people in to copy the vote. So that's going to be what those indictments are. I hope nobody thinks it's coming for Trump. She's coming for the people that clearly we've caught them on camera. We knew they did this. Maybe Sidney Powell. Maybe Mike Lindell. Ends up in jail for something.
Right.
But it's going to be people like that or their underlings. We're not going to see Trump or Junior or Eric
or even
Kushner.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens out of the U.S., out of New York State Attorney General's office. We'll see.
So having said all of that, you know, we've talked about the midterms. We've talked about Trump. What about you? The audience, I know they miss you. I know they love you.
I will not be in jail. I'm hoping this time next year. I'm hoping not to be in jail.
Well, we're all hoping that, but, you know, we've got a few days left at this conference, so who knows? I mean, there's anything could happen.
That's true.
Majority Report has crossed 1 million subscribers. That is a huge milestone. There's only a handful of progressive channels that have done it.
My daughter and my son are very excited about it.
Did you get the gold play button?
I got the gold. I got the silver and the gold. Maybe a silver at 100,000.
Yeah, silver at 100. And
but
then...
it is honestly like my son is super excited. He wanted to see the play button.
That's great. You know, we at Ring of Fire, we're still pushing it. You know, we're in the upper 800s, so maybe by this time next year, we can hit it too. But I can't stress enough that really is a very unique distinction. You know, you, Pac-Man, Brian Tyler Cohen, TYT, and I don't know if there's anybody else that's hit 1 million on the progressive side, on the real progressive side, not the.
I don't know. I mean, all those names that you listed, including I think Ring of Fire, probably do more numbers than we do. I think, you know, I think some of our audience are people who come to politics more when there's a real, real, like, tremendous sense of energy, urgency. We have a young audience. Our audience, I mean, you've seen the numbers. We've talked about this. Our audience is very young, and which I, you know, I mean, I would...
I would be just as happy to have an old audience as a young audience. But it, I think it we do two things on the show on a daily basis. One is we do like an in-depth interview almost every day on history or policy or, you know, or theory, and so that we can contextualize this moment that we're in, whatever given moment it is. And then we, the second half of our show is basically like AM talk radio mocking, for the most part, right-wingers, and then other people who don't, who pretend they're not right-wingers. And so I think like our audiences, you know, those are pretty, two pretty disparate things that we're servicing simultaneously. And I think that probably inhibits, a daily viewership, but allows for a subscriber, you know, an expansion of subscriber, because there's two different sort of like types of people who like what we do, but we don't service them in the same, you know, in a consistent way every time. And so people subscribe, I think, and then maybe watch a little bit less than they would, you know, on other channels. It's just a theory, but yeah, no, it's exciting. I mean, it's exciting. And I, you know, I've been doing this iteration of the show for 12 years and was doing, you know, the first Majority Report back in 2004, and then had some period in between, but that was, you know, on radio. And I'm happy where we're at. I'm, you know, like I would love more people to listen to the show. Of course, that's why we do what we do. But I like my audience. I think, you know, my audience is full of a lot of people who are going out and doing a bunch of stuff. Like, you know, I'm preaching to the choir, and they're going out and doing bake sales, and they're going out and, you know, helping the congregation, as it were. And, you know, I don't want to belabor this too much, but they're doing some very important work that hopefully emanates out. So I'm more happy with the nature and the qualitative aspects of my audience than I am in terms of the numbers. But like I say, my kids get super excited about it, and they brag to their friends.
So. Well, that's wonderful. And on top of all of that, though, you know, you could probably double those numbers in like a month. All you get is you start saying words like fraud squad. You start questioning vaccines a little bit. Suddenly, boom, you're 2-3 million subscriber. No, we all know what we're getting at there. Sam is not a fake leftist. He's not fallen off the map. And he never will. He's been doing this, like he said, since 04. And Ring of Fire has been right there next to you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we many times in the early days of Air America, going up to the big studio and seeing the
without a doubt,
the shenanigans that took place up there. It's almost remarkable given – and look, we loved Air America, but – given the dysfunction that existed at that network, the fact that we were all able to continue on doing this blows my mind.
I'm going to tell you this. It would have been irrational for our audience at that time, because a lot of people would write in and say this. There has to be some type of like Republican plant or mole in the organization. And it would have... It was a perfectly rational response because of the level of incompetence that was involved in the management of Air America five times over. Like, it was, what do we have? Five different owners and six different CEOs. And the incompetence at that level was amazing. And it was perfectly rational for people to think that somebody was trying to sabotage it within, because it's almost like, how else could it go this wrong? Well, it could go that wrong because it was an amazing incompetence. But the shows existed. The audience existed. And, you know, we're still here.
Yeah, and I mean, for the most part, most of the folks that were on that network are still going. Tom's still out there doing his stuff every day. A wonderful guy. Obviously, I think everybody knows where Rachel Maddow is. You know, Stephanie Miller. A lot of good.
Stephanie Miller was never technically.
She was not. Okay.
But Mark Maron's had quite a bit of success.
Yeah,
since
yeah.
Then. Randy Rhodes, I think, is still doing a show.
That's who I was. I'm sorry.
And Al Franken has a podcast. And I suspect we may be hearing more from him in the coming years. Who knows? But, yeah, it was an interesting legacy.
And, of course, thanks in no small part to you, Ring of Fire is still here.
Yep.
And if you had not carried that torch for us for all those years, you know, Pap and Bobby – you know, Pap obviously still involved with America's Lawyer through Ring of Fire, but you know, you carried that podcast for God, I don't even know how long it's been.
I have no idea.
So, of course, in saying that, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you back. I know the audience loves it, so hey, anytime, you know where we are.
All right. Well, Farron, I appreciate it. Real pleasure. And I think you're doing a great job with this, and keep it up.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And listen, everybody, that's all the time we've got for today. But if you want the full show every single week, sign up and become a member at ROFpodcast.com. In addition to getting the full show, you will also get access to the entirety of the Ring of Fire podcast archives. I'm Farron Cousins. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and even TikTok if you're so inclined. I'm at Farron Balanced on all four of those platforms. Thank you so much for joining us this week. Have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you next time.